Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Hi, everybody. It's another episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast. And this week we have Oliver Schwenk join us. He's a senior economist in the Financing for Sustainable Development Office of the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and one of the authors of the 2022 Financing for Sustainable Development Report, Bridging the Finance Divide. He's part of the policy analysis team that leads the substantial follow-up to the Addis Ababa Action Agenda on Financing for Development and focuses on debt sustainability and integrated financing frameworks. Now, prior to his current role, he held various positions in the Secretariat of the United Nations, including as part of the writing team of the World Economic and Social Survey, which is a flagship UN publication, and in the Office of the Special Advisor on Africa. He also was a consultant with UNIDO and a lecturer in development economics at the Vienna University of Economics and Business at the University of Vienna. He holds a doctorate in economics from the Vienna University of Economics and Business. And this week, Oliver Schwenk is joining us to talk about the green economy in development. Hello, Oliver.
Hi, Bob. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure, and great timing, by the way, for you to join us here on GDP, just as the United Nations Financing for Development and DESA have just released a new report that says that the new green industrial age could be a breakthrough for sustainable development goals. So I want to talk to you about what maybe is in that report, and then, you know, also what is this new green industrial age that we're talking about, and maybe you can tell us about some of the financing mechanisms behind it all.
Sure. Happy to do that. So this report is part of a series. We publish an annual assessment of the state of development finance globally, the Financing for Sustainable Development reports. And this year, indeed, we have a focus on green industrial policies and the new green industrial age that we see. And we talk about the opportunity this brings for countries to get back on track on achieving the sustainable development goals. As you know, it's been a very challenging couple of years for global development and for global development finance with the pandemic, the impact of the war in Ukraine, and other shocks that have hit developing countries particularly hard. And the result of that is that we see a real divergence in economic and sustainable development prospects, a divergence between countries that were able to respond to the crisis aggressively because they had the fiscal space, because they had access to financing cheaply in markets, and those countries that did not have that, and that's largely developing countries. That's the finance divide we identified last year. And because, you know, despite efforts of the international community, we haven't really done enough to close that divide. So that finance divide is really translating into a sustainable development divide. Our department has recently put out our assessment of global economic prospects, and it shows that in the poorest countries, they are still far below the growth pathways that were projected prior to the pandemic. I think in some cases, up to 7-8 percentage points lower per capita GDP than we had expected in 2019. That's the poorest countries. In the advanced economies, many of them have basically caught up or just 1 or 2 percentage points below pre-crisis growth paths. So we see a real divergence that shows up, for example, in increasing poverty rates for the first time in many years. And financing, or the differential access to financing, as one of the main underlying reasons for that divide. Now, so for us, for the UN as the custodian of the Sustainable Development Goals, the climate agenda, the big question for us is how do we get back on track? How can we help the poorer countries catch up and get back on a path towards achieving these goals that we've agreed to achieve by 2030? And that's where the new green industrial age come in. I think historically, it's quite clear that industrial development and structural transformation have often been at the heart of sustained growth and poverty reduction. Now we see a revival of industrial policies, particularly in advanced economies, but across the world for a number of reasons that we can talk about. And because this area, which has for quite a while been almost a taboo or a dirty word, has made a comeback, that opens space for developing countries also to pursue industrial transformations. That's something they can do on their own at the national level, but for which they will also need international support, both in access to finance and access to technology. So just to complete here, this is the first of our main recommendations, but there are two others that are more pertain to the international community. One is that for developing countries to be able to invest in these transformations, they do need access to more financing on better terms. You know, that includes concessional financing, also lending on more concessional terms, and improvements in the international financial architecture so that the borrowing terms that they face in markets are more favorable. Right now, they pay a very high premium in markets. That partly reflects higher risk, but it's partly also for systemic reasons that we can try to tackle so that we bring down the cost of capital in these countries as well, and so that they can invest in transformation.
So are the economic barriers, is that what's keeping developing nations back from kind of jumping on the green industrial era, if we call it like that? Or is there something else maybe about the technology being accessible? Or are there political reasons why this hasn't happened beforehand? I'm just trying to get a sense of what it would take to really move this motion forward to get more countries participating in a green industrial revolution.
Yeah, sure. So I think one way to think about this is to think about where this would need to happen. So we are really here in this case talking about firms, the private sector, corporations, right, in the real economy that have to build those capabilities to be able to succeed in these sectors. These are mostly tradable sectors, right? So we are really talking about building the competitiveness of the private sector in developing countries to be able to succeed in these modern green sectors, to be able to adopt clean energy technologies, etc. So the question is, how can we do that? And it is true that the capability gaps are really large. So when you think about firms in developing countries, they are often far behind or far away from the technology frontier. So this is a really challenging agenda. From our perspective, you know, we of course, our entry point is financing. So I think financing does play an important role. Access to affordable financing is really critical. So you can take as an example, renewable energy investments and what it costs to mobilize financing for an investment in, you know, a clean power plant or a solar project. And the costs of capital really differ greatly, you know, whether you do that in Germany or you do that in a developing country. There are estimates that they are 7 times higher, in fact, in some developing countries. And that's not a reflection of the technology risks, right? So the technology that you use would be the same if it's an international investor. The difference in the cost of capital comes from the broader macroeconomic challenges, the higher cost of finance generally in these countries. So I think that is a really central aspect. But you're right that finance is not the only one. So I think access to technology is really critical. And, you know, even if countries or companies have access to the technology, the question is, do they have the capacity, the capability to absorb it, to adapt it to the local contexts? And do they have the economic incentives to do so? You know, is there a business case to invest in a green technology over traditional technologies? And in each of these areas, there are things governments can do and things that the international community can do to improve the case, you know, to improve the business case. And we can go through that list. I think on the capability side, what usually or almost always comes out as the most binding constraint is human capital, right? The skills of the workforce. And there's no short-term solution for that. So these are just this is the hard work of development, if you like, to invest in building up these capabilities and in enabling domestic business sectors to succeed in these sectors.
Right. And it seems interesting, though, that, you know, the way that these movements kind of gain enthusiasm usually starts with a particular moment. And I'm wondering if the energy crisis that's come out of the war in Ukraine has been in some sort of a trigger for pursuing this agenda and then opening up financing for countries in the global South to then, you know, begin to get access to this technology. Am I off on that? Like did the energy crisis in Ukraine, you know, play a factor in this? And if it did, why now? Why did it take until this moment to begin to get more excited about green technology?
I think it certainly has. I would say maybe one way to put this is it has supercharged a movement or a momentum that was already ongoing. I think it's one, and at this point, certainly the most important driver of this really significant scaling up of investments in this area that we see. So just to as your listeners will probably know, 2022, we had the largest investment ever in the energy transition, and for the first time, investments in the energy transition and clean energy exceeded investments in the fossil fuel industry. So there is a real change happening. And I think the energy crisis triggered by the war in Ukraine is an important immediate trigger, but it comes on top of a number of trends that have prepared the ground, right? I think one can go back as late as the 2007, 2008 global economic and financial crisis. The fallout from that, the very slow recovery and the political fallout from that, that has, I think, really triggered a rethink of where our priorities should be in economic policy making. And it has put the emphasis back on the question of productive capabilities, where we produce things, where we create decent jobs. You know, I think in the context of advanced economies, one very very visible trend from that was this emphasis on place-based policies, investing in regions that are being left behind, which is in a way a form of industrial policy. And that was perhaps the first sign that we are seeing this revival of industrial policies focusing on the productive sphere. And then I think the pandemic added to that, right? There was a realization that if we don't have this capacities to produce certain critical products nationally, there's a real dependence on a vulnerability to external shocks. And then the war in Ukraine and the fallout has just supercharged that. I think there's also, with that, of course, the geopolitical dimension to this, right? So this desire to reduce vulnerabilities to external shocks, but also to, you know, to other economies that, you know, where we may be entering an age of geostrategic competition. So all of this plays together, some of it, you know, a real opportunity for this agenda of investing in the transitions of our energy sector's economies. Of course, there are also risks associated with that. That's very clear. But I think all these factors are coming together, and what they lead to is, you know, these really significant, massive investments, policy packages to support sustainable transitions, which, you know, from a climate perspective is certainly desirable.
Right. And, you know, it's worth asking then what, like, how big would you say then is, you know, in terms of financing, I guess the market, but in terms of how large is the scale of the global green economy today, if we can quantify that in any way?
There are different efforts to do that. In our report, we cite the effort by one research company that tries to estimate the size of the green economy in terms of the market share of companies exposed to or active in the sector and their market capitalization. And they come to the conclusion that the green economy already accounts for 7% of global equity markets. It's also around $7 trillion. That may not sound as large, but that means it's larger than some, you know, very significant sectors such as finance or retail. So it is a really significant and maybe what's even more important, very fast growing sector. And if you zoom in, so that's all kinds of activities that support this green transformation. At the heart of it is, of course, the energy sector. And again, I don't know if I mentioned before, but if you look at the energy sector and renewable energy investments, we are talking about now more than $1 trillion a year invested in the energy transition. And as I mentioned, exceeding investments in the fossil fuel economy. And thus, all projections indicate that we can expect to continue to see rapid growth in these areas. Now, one qualification I think we have to make at this point is that these investments are geographically concentrated. Essentially, we are talking about developed countries and China that account for the vast majority of these investments. So again, we're coming back to the issue of the divide. Many poor countries are not investing, or at least nowhere near at that scale, in the green economy.
Right. So we're looking at, you know, again, currently this being a very reserved initiative that those in you know, the global north are seeing the visibility of this a lot more than in the global south. I mean, it's, you know, I'm just thinking just off the top of my head, how many taxi fleets are now being electrified in cities like London and, you know, other areas like this, and police cars moving over to being e-vehicles in certain cities and counties in the U.S. But at the end of the day, there's still a lot of carbon that gets burned for people to do the day-to-day in the global south. So I guess the last question I'll just throw at you there is, with the financing specifically and maybe other ideas that you might have along the way, how can developing countries really participate in this agenda? I mean, what sectors do you see financing moving countries to invest in? And is it in some cases just that the technology is going to be still too far out of reach for many?
Yeah, so I think actually there are many reasons to be optimistic too. I probably came across as quite pessimistic, but I think one thing that we cannot forget is that with the scale of investment, there's also a really rapid improvement in the effectiveness and the cost effectiveness of these new technologies. Again, you know, with renewable energies being a fantastic example. So these technologies are becoming cost competitive, you know, and with that, they also become attractive for developing countries that might have faced very different challenges, right? Managing competing interests of, you know, we need to rapidly scale up access to energy. We want to preserve local environments, but also contribute to climate mitigation. These trade-offs become easier to manage as the cost of these new technologies is coming down. So I think that's the good news, but still, there's different estimates of what the investment gap is in achieving these transformations, but inevitably the numbers are very large. You know, I think the most recent that our colleagues in the OECD have put out is that there's a $4 trillion annual investment gap in developing countries that covers not just the green transformation, but the sustainable development agenda more broadly. So I think there's no way around thinking about the financing questions and how to improve access to financing for developing countries. This is widely recognized. So this week in Washington, D.C., we have the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And the question of how we can scale up development financing, concessional lending by development banks is on the top of everyone's mind. I think the question only is how ambitious will we be in this reform agenda, but I think it's really widely understood that we need to scale up provision of financing at the right terms, right? At interest rates that make it viable to invest in these types of projects. And then the second point that we had talked about earlier is access to the right technologies. There's a national dimension to that, so investing in the absorptive capacities of countries. But there is also an international dimension to this. So sharing, providing access to technologies, and I think particularly in cases where it's public money that pays for the development of these technologies, right? As we see advanced economies putting a lot of public money behind these transitions, if that public funding paid for these technologies, then I think there's a strong case to be made that they should also be made widely available to other countries that can contribute their share to climate mitigation.
Well, it's an interesting point that you make about, you know, making sure the interest rates are correct on this. And, you know, as we've discussed in the series before, finance, interest rates, taxation, whichever way you want to look at it, really go far in helping to promote certain types of human behavior. And in this case, if there is a commitment to get this technology accessible for the global South, it might have to be a question that's asked, well, can there be a different scale of interest rates and a different scale of packaging for countries in the South to develop these technologies, as opposed to saying, no, it would just be cheaper if we went with the old dirty industry. Well, not if that interest rate is playing into the factor, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I think there's a lot of thinking about how this can be done, right? How can we bring down costs for specific projects in this sector? You know, the whole discussion around blended finance in a way is precisely that.
Yeah.
How can you make the public money go further, right? How can we leverage private financing by, you know, maybe taking a share of the risk on the public side through guarantees, maybe by subsidizing the lending, bringing down the interest cost to put some of these projects over the margin and make them attractive to private investors. There's a lot of work ongoing, a lot of interesting ideas, but, you know, there's a real urgency to this agenda, so we need to get our act together and move quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope in those discussions that some of the previous models that we've seen in the global north to incentivize people to buy e-bikes or e-cars kind of get overlooked, because I remember some jurisdictions were offering, $50 tax breaks if you bought like a $4,000 e-bike. Well, no, that's not the way to think about this. We need this sort of progressive and very brave financing that you mentioned here, Oscar. So, Oliver, thank you very much for sharing that. And, good luck with the meetings coming up in Washington with the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And the work that you've put in so far will no doubt be an important pillar to these discussions. So thank you for sharing that with us today on GDP.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.